Well, my thanks to Barry and to Dave for bringing you the video regarding Jabal El-Laws as the most likely site for the actual Mountain of God, the Sinai Mountain, Mount Horeb, whatever name is the one you're looking at in the scriptures to have reference to it. What did you think of those videos? Pretty good. I'm sure you picked up there was a lot of video we could have shown you, but if we recognize from what we saw in the previous videos about where the crossing is, it pretty well wipes out all the other possibilities if you follow along in the story of Exodus. So we didn't waste your time. If somebody wants to see some of those others to see the thought process behind it, I mean, I've got them, I'll loan them to you, but it's pretty evident where the sea crossing is, I believe, from what we saw earlier. We'll mention that again today a little bit before we're done. But anyway, thanks to Barry and Dave. Any comments about what you saw that you want to highlight? Not that I necessarily expect that you will, but you might. All right. Well, from our presentation the last time we were in the text on May 19th, that far back, we were in Exodus chapter 13, and we looked at the first 16 verses, and it really is the implementation of God's direction given through Moses to sanctify to him every firstborn, both of man and beast. And it's related to the final plague in Egypt. God spared the firstborn man and beast of the Israelites as they put the blood on the doorposts, as they went through the commanded directions for the Passover supper. And so God spared them. And so now, as a result of him sparing those people, as kind of a connection to that, God wants those people dedicated to him. And his words are actually, sanctify them for me, which means to set them apart, to make them special to him. And so when Moses is given this command, his next step is to go to the people. And he doesn't start out with that. He reminds them of the Feast of Unleavened Bread and the 7 days and how they're to keep that as individuals as well as a nation, to get rid of any leavening within their borders for those 7 days. It's to be done annually, the first month of the year, and of course the year calendar changes. The first month is the month that the Passover occurs, and God said from now on that's going to be the first month of your year. And part of what they are to remember is that this was the powerful hand of God that took them out of Egypt. So when you're celebrating, tell your children, tell your sons about the mighty hand of God and the work that the Lord did, and put these as a reminder on your hand and your forehead, which later in time would become the phylacteries that they actually use, a leather little pouch on their forehead and hand to remind them. They put scripture in there to remind them of what God has done. And he says, when the Lord brings you to Canaan, then devote your first offspring. So that's what Moses then introduces, the idea of sanctifying the firstborn. And it's supposed to be man and beast. And God says, now if it's like a donkey, you have a choice. You can redeem that donkey by sacrificing a lamb, or you can break the donkey's neck. In other words, this donkey is not going to be a benefit from you for you. It's to be a benefit to God, either substitutionally with the lamb or by taking the donkey's life. If it's a son, he doesn't give them that choice. He says, you shall redeem the son with sacrifice. And we looked at when that even happened for Jesus. They brought the sacrifice to the temple, the poor people's version of redeeming a firstborn. And so even at the time of Jesus, this was done, and done for Jesus himself. And then the direction is given, when your son asks, tell him again what happened in God's mighty hand, bringing them out of slavery and the sign on the forehead and the hand in the form of the phylacteries as what they would become over time. So that kind of takes us through where we were in Exodus chapter 13. So let's go back over to chapter 13 now. We're going to finish that chapter and see how far we get into 14. So first of all, let me read to you Exodus 13, 17 through 22. Now when Pharaoh had let the people go, God did not lead them by the way of the land of the Philistines, even though it was near. For God said the people might change their minds when they see war and return to Egypt. Hence God led the people around by the way of the wilderness to the Red Sea, and the sons of Israel went up in martial array from the land of Egypt. Moses took the bones of Joseph with him, for he had made the sons of Israel solemnly swear, saying, God will surely take care of you, and you shall carry my bones from here with you. Then they set out from Succoth and camped at Etham, or Etham, on the edge of the wilderness. The Lord was going before them in a pillar of cloud by day to lead them on the way, and a pillar of fire by night to give them light, that they might travel by day and by night. He did not take away the pillar of cloud by day, nor the pillar of fire by night, there from before the people. All right, well, you will probably remember some of this from some of the videos that we talked about. But starting with verse 17, Pharaoh released the people, and God leading them did not take them by the way of the Philistines, even though that was closer. God said the people might change their minds and if they see war and go back to Egypt. So what might be the ones who would war with them if they went the closer route? Maybe let's stop and talk for a minute. I updated with a few more comments my scratchy handwriting on the map, so I put a new one out there for you if you didn't pick it up already. But the way, if you look at that map, the way of the Philistines would be going up toward Canaan through the Negev up there, general direction of Hormah and Hebron. Hebron's up in there, but you're going to have to go around the bottom end of the Mediterranean there. And so it would be going up right along the coast, basically, to get to Canaan, the promised land. So who would they be doing war with if they had gone that way?
The Philistines.
The Philistines and those like them. So the land that they're going to is described often. Do you remember some of the description about what land it is? It would go through a list of different peoples, the Canaanites and the Hittites and the Jebusites. And so they're not going to a land that's unoccupied. They're going to a land that is already possessed by somebody else. And they're also going to be traveling through areas of people's groups that they had interacted with in their previous history, and they're going to be considered outsiders. So if you saw, this might be a little too close to home, but if you saw 600,000 men and their families coming into your country, I'm not trying to speak politically, would you go, hey, yeah, there's plenty of room here. Take that piece of land over. No. I mean, 600,000 people and their men and their families, it's clear when they come through that they're going to be a burden, right? At a minimum, they're going to be a burden. And at most, they're going to come in and take your land away from you so they can live on it, right? And so here are these people coming up, and they're not going to be well received. And indeed, when they go the roundabout way, they're not well received, are they? They don't come up through the land of the Philistines, but they come in from the other side, but they're not welcomed with open arms. And you certainly wouldn't expect them to be, because God's direction to them when you go study that is, oh, by the way, don't leave anybody living. So, you know, this isn't going to be a fun confrontation. And then God says, what does he expect their reaction to be if they saw war?
Go back to Egypt.
Yeah, do you think God knows these Israelites pretty well? Yeah, he does, doesn't he? And they continually show that side of who they are throughout their trek to the promised land. And we'll see some of it today before we get done, depending on how far we get. So they didn't go by the way of the Philistines. Instead, in verse 18, God led them by the wilderness way in the direction of the Red Sea. Now, I put those words in based on the videos that we've seen. But they're headed by toward the Red Sea and through the wilderness. And my little scratchy mark on here is not intended to be, oh, they went north here and then south. No, it's just showing a wandering way through the wilderness over toward the Gulf of Aqaba, which is a part of the Red Sea. And so that's the path that he's taking them on. And it says they went up in martial array, probably both formation as well as their personal dress would be a battle dress. So they went out in a military type posture as they went. And then in verse 19, it said that Moses took Joseph's bones. Let's go over and remind ourselves of Genesis 50. We're going to look at verses 22 through 26. This is Joseph in his last hours, and he is pretty clear what he expects out of his brothers. And he has every right to have expectations of them from multiple perspectives. One perspective is, what's his role in Egypt? He's second only to Pharaoh, so can he make demands of people? Absolutely. What's his role with respect to his brothers?
He helped them survive.
He saved them physically, not spiritually, but he was their physical salvation. They would have starved. But he brought them to Egypt, and not only did he bring them to Egypt, but he gave them the best of the land. And then God prospered them greatly. And so Joseph makes this kind of statement beginning in verse 22 of chapter 50. Now Joseph stayed in Egypt, he and his father's household, and Joseph lived 110 years. Joseph saw the third generation of Ephraim's sons, also the sons of Micher, the son of Manasseh, were born on Joseph's knees. Joseph said to his brothers, I'm about to die, but God will surely take care of you and bring you up from this land to the land which he promised on oath to Abraham, to Isaac, and to Jacob. Then Joseph made the sons of Israel swear, saying, God will surely take care of you, and you shall carry my bones up from here. So Joseph died at the age of 110 years, and he was embalmed and placed in a coffin in Egypt. So Joseph's demand of them was, when God fulfills the promise and expressed his faith in the promise, and the promise was even made to Jacob upon the beginning of his move to Egypt. If you recall, God said to him, don't fear going. Because in Egypt, I will make a nation of you, and surely I, meaning God, will bring your offspring out of Egypt as a nation. And so the promise had been made originally to Abraham that he would make a great nation of them. And then the promise is repeated and even clarified for Jacob. So Joseph was placed in a coffin in Egypt, and it was expected by Joseph that when the day came that they were taken out of Egypt, his remains, now down to bones, would go with them. Do you remember from the archaeological evidence that we saw from David Roll's presentation, the evidence that that indeed happened? Remember where the burial of Joseph was, in all probability? Remember they went through the castle of the palace of Joseph, and outside were 12 burial places, and these clearly were rich people, but one of the burial places had the shape of a pyramid over it, which was not done in Joseph's era, so that was something unusual. And the grave was, the actual resting place was under this tomb. And when they did the archaeological work, they found that someone had bored a hole in there and taken the bones. And grave robbers don't take bones. And by what we're seeing here, Moses either did that or commanded it be done. And there was a statue of Joseph, probably Joseph there. You remember all that? That's fun. I've got the David Roll stuff, and if you want to look at that video, let me know. That's pretty amazing what they found in the archaeological work to understand the area of Goshen, or Avaris as it was called by the time of the Exodus, and what they found there when they dug down deep enough to get to the right dates. And so we've got the archaeological evidence that certainly looks like it lines right up with this. And in verse 19, Moses is taking Joseph's bones to fulfill the promise. So in verse 20, it says, they set out from Succoth. Why were they in Succoth? You remember? Go back and look at Exodus 12:37. Exodus 12:37 shows us the beginning of the Exodus, and it's right after the Passover. It's right after the people have given them all the stuff and said, get out of here. And it says in verse 37, now the sons of Israel journeyed from Ramses to Succoth, about 600,000 men on foot, aside from children. So Succoth was their first stopping point. And this map, before I did any writing on it, you can see it had a Succoth on it. Don't depend on that being the location of Succoth. We don't know exactly where it was, but it looks like a pretty short journey in the way that Exodus reads, because Moses is being instructed by God to give them more information about the way that they're to celebrate what's happened, and especially with regard to the consecration of the firstborn. And so it looks like it's pretty close. By the way, when we talked about who they might go to war with, we didn't mention Egyptians. Why wouldn't they go to war with the Egyptians in this early part of the trip? They were giving them goods to go. All the Egyptians wanted at that point was get out of here. Now, that's the Egyptian people. But Pharaoh had called in Moses and Aaron and said, okay, take all your stuff and get. I've had enough. Go. And so at this point, they're traveling with, I don't want to say the blessing, but the direction has been given by Pharaoh that they should go. So the last thing that probably would happen is the army try to turn them around. At this point, nobody wants them back. They want them gone. And so they have gone. They've got Joseph's bones. They're leaving Succoth in verse 20. And that was their first stopping point. And then as we keep reading in verse 20, it said, they went from Succoth I want to see it in the words here again. They went from Succoth and then camped at Etham or Etham, or I'm not sure the exact best way to say it. You hear it different ways. I put on the map what we got out of the video. You remember the videos? I was going to reference them more specifically in a minute. But Dr. Glenn Fritz, interviewed by Tim Mahoney, and he's talking about all the geographical information that helps us know, and we're going to cover that if we get over into verse 14, or chapter 14. And that's where he placed Etham. It is a normal camping area if you're going to go through the wilderness to get to Midian. And so there's a broad plain up there. There's plenty of water. It's really the only really good stopping point before you would go around the north of the Gulf of Aqaba there and go down into Midian. So that was a common part of the trade route. They would stop there at Etham, and there they would be. And so they're camping there. And in verse 21, I really like these words. The scriptures tell us that God made his presence known in a pillar of cloud by day to lead them, and a pillar of fire by night to give them light. So that, why?
You can travel both day.
Travel day and night. And that might be important as we continue our discussion. And in verse 22, we've got a verse that says just simply, and he did not remove the pillar of cloud or the pillar of fire. It was always there. And we didn't take you through all the painful kinds of videos where people were talking about, well, the Exodus had to go this route up here because you have to have a volcano to get that pillar of fire. Excuse me? That pillar of fire wasn't just a volcano that squirted up in one place. This pillar of fire moved with them. Okay? So all of the looking for natural phenomenon to make all of the things work in this account of getting across the Red Sea and then over on into Mount Sinai is silliness. Because the pillar of cloud was there all the time, and the pillar of fire was there, and the pillar of fire was adequate, so 600,000 men and their families could see to travel at night. Suppose that was an impressive pillar of fire? I think that probably was really something. But we also need to be careful that we don't make our own foolish mistake when we think about God and the pillar of cloud and the pillar of fire. Is that where God was? Kind of a trick question. Because the answer is yes. God was inhabiting, it was a part of his presentation to the people as a pillar of cloud and the pillar of fire. But was that the limit of God? God is omniscient. God is everywhere at all times, omnipresent. God is all-seeing. God is all-knowing. God is everywhere all at once. And so this was his marker to show them how to travel, but it did not limit the location of God and where God was. And later they're going to build a traveling tent temple called the Tabernacle, and then there's going to be the Holy of Holies, and there's a special presence of God in that Holy of Holies. But does that limit where God is? Is that only place where God is found? Absolutely not. And so here is God inhabiting this pillar of cloud and this pillar of fire. And so this natural phenomenon idea that people that try to figure out the Exodus by saying, well, how far could you travel in a day? Well, what did we just learn? Did they travel only by days? No. They've got a miracle going on so that they know the path to take, and they can see the path at night. They can travel day and night. We don't know how much God, it isn't mentioned. I can't make a case for out of the scriptures something exact, but I think clearly God is giving them stamina, maybe giving them speed. So all of our human calculations, they're interesting to think about. Well, how far was that? How far would people normally travel? That's interesting information, but it in no way limits what may have happened here as they're making their path across the desert to get to Etham, and then on from there as we continue to look at that. How long did it take them to get to Etham? I just gave you the answer to that, in a way. We don't know. There's nothing in the scriptures that say it. It just says they camped at Succoth and they camped then at Etham. And they made a camp at Etham. Did they make any camps in between, or did they just travel the whole way? We don't know. But we do know they left Succoth and then they made a major camping stop at Etham. And part of the reason for telling us that is what God plans to do with them to redirect them from where they thought they were going, probably, to a different path out of Etham. So, we don't know what effect the supernatural had, but they're at Etham. And, let's see, did I confuse myself? Because that should have been verse, turn back. That should have been verse 22, and it is. So they made their way to Etham and led as we described. So I want to move on to chapter 14. Any questions, comments, thoughts? This is the beginning of the Exodus, and it's really a big deal. God is establishing how he's doing this, and God is really in control. God didn't say to Moses, okay, go find your way to Etham. God led them through the pillar of cloud and lighted their way with the pillar of fire. We're going to get some of God's directions here, but then God continues to lead them because it said he didn't take away either of those two pillars. And so this is a big deal that we've seen so far that tells us about how God was working with them as they departed from Egypt. So let's go on with chapter 14. I'm just going to start with the first four verses. So they're at Etham, and now the Lord spoke to Moses, saying, tell the sons of Israel to turn back and camp before Pi Hahiroth, between Migdol and the sea. You shall camp in front of Baal Zephon, opposite it by the sea. For Pharaoh will say of the sons of Israel, they are wandering aimlessly in the land. The wilderness has shut them in. Thus I will harden Pharaoh's heart, and he will chase after them, and I will be honored through Pharaoh and all his army, and the Egyptians will know that I am the Lord. And they did so. All right, let's work our way through that. It starts out in verse 1 of 14. Tell the sons of Israel, and the New American Standard says, turn back. Well, if you remember the videos with Dr. Glenn Fritz, and I'm going to pull some of that back in here, that really didn't mean reverse course and go back where you were. That meant we're going to make a significant course direction change here. And the further directions we're given tell us which way they're going to go because of the way the geography is there and what the words mean. So turn back, and you're going to camp before Pi Hahiroth. Now, that term Pi Hahiroth, the P part means the mouth. And it's different than the way we think about, like if we said the mouth of the river, we'd say that's where it comes out. But in their case, it's more like the model to start with might be your own mouth. That's where things go in. So it means the going in place or the starting place. And Hahiroth talks about caves or holes. And so we're talking about the entrance to caves or holes. And you're going to camp before that. And there is the Wadi of Atir that I put something fairly arbitrarily on the map and called it Pi Hahiroth. And it's in that general area. That's by no means intended to be an exacting point. But there, this wadi begins south of Etham. And this wadi, which is a kind of a valley or a drainage ditch or a canyon maybe, this particular one is very, very narrow. And the walls are very high. And so you start down this limiting cavern. It's not a cavern, limiting a canyon with very straight walls about halfway from Etham to where they're going to get down to the crossing for the sea south of there. And so that's the entrance point that we're talking about. And it seems cavern-like because it's very tall. There's tall mountains there. And as you go down, the mountains get higher as you go down, as you go south. The mountains get higher and the canyon floor goes down. So they keep getting higher and higher as you go down through that set of a canyon. And he says you're going to camp between Migdol and the sea. Well, according to Dr. Fritz, there are very high mountains that are visible all along anywhere almost in that Sinai Peninsula. Those mountains are over in the general direction of the Gulf of Suez, over to the east. I'm sorry, over to the west. And that word Migdol really means tower or tall place. So when Dr. Glenn Fritz put it together, he said, so you're going to be between those mountains and the sea is where your camping place is going to be. We know from everything we looked at in that same video series that the Gulf of Aqaba is certainly the sea mentioned in the crossing that's coming up. So they're going to be camping at a place where they're between the sea and those mountains, according to Dr. Fritz. And it's going to be in front of Baal Zephon. Well, on the map, I put an arrow pointing up to Baal Zephon. It's well north of there. It's north of Israel itself, but it's along the coast of the Mediterranean Sea. And when it says in front of, it means facing. And so the entrance to Pi Hahiroth faces up to Baal Zephon. Baal Zephon is the name of a god that was worshipped by the Canaanites and others. It was the god of the north, and it was a home of this ancient god. And according to Dr. Fritz, this is a common way of citing direction. It faces some landmark. In this case, the landmark is Baal Zephon. Interestingly enough, as time goes by with the Hebrew language, Zephon will become the word for north. So Dr. Fritz puts all this together to say they're going to come down through the canyon and over to where I arbitrarily, not too arbitrarily, because it showed it on the map there. There's a bit of a beach, and it's there by a modern city of Nuweiba. But it's the beach, and really the only beach, along the shore of the Gulf of Aqaba. And when we get to the crossing, we'll talk more about it. But it's also the place that, in terms of the geography, you could actually walk if the sea were parted from this beach across the Gulf of Aqaba to the other side without having to be a mountain climber or something like that. It actually would work very well, despite the fact you're going to be going down about a half a mile when you get down there in the middle. That's how deep you would be. I probably have left a couple of things out. Anybody have any questions or comments? Anything you remember from the video series that you think I should have said there that I neglected to do so? And they're camping facing Pi Hahiroth, meaning they're when they get there, they're going to come out of this wadi, out of this canyon, and when they camp, they're actually going to camp so they're looking not toward the sea, but back toward the direction they came. Yes, sir.
Yeah, I was going to mention, I did mention last week before we started that video on Sinai, that in Exodus 19, Moses writes that he bore, God bore them up as on eagle's wings.
Mm-hmm.
And he repeats that in Deuteronomy 32, when he writes a song of Moses during the end of his life.
Yes.
He again says that journey was like being born up on eagle's wings. So it's real obvious that in Moses' mind, the easiest thing he could relate that journey to was an eagle soaring.
Yeah.
And flying. And so if you think about that, it's obviously the supernatural part.
Right.
And there was little effort and little trouble on their journey from Goshen to the Way Bay and then on to Sinai.
Yep.
And I think they went fast, day and night, without any like eagle soaring from Goshen mm-hmm. to Sinai.
Yeah, I mean, there's nothing, I agree with you, and there's nothing mentioned between Succoth to Etham down to their campsite on the Gulf of Aqaba as, oh, we had to climb over rocks. I mean, anything, no problems mentioned, and I think that lines right up with what Dave's saying. By the way, I do have this in here, and it relates to that a little bit. If you want to get some perspective from where they think Etham probably was, and we really don't know, but we have a general area using what Dr. Glenn Fritz put together. We do know where the beach is on the Gulf of Aqaba, but it's about 67 miles from Etham down to that beach, just to give you a perspective when you're looking at the map. We sometimes look at these and we think in our U.S. proportions, and it doesn't work. Yet, on foot, anybody want to go 67 miles through a rock canyon today? So it doesn't mean it was easy, but it certainly isn't the kind of distances we might expect just looking at a map. Okay.
I have a question.
Yes, sir.
Rick, in Numbers 33,
okay,
verse 7, it talks about the camp being east of Bel Safon.
Okay.
So I just got curious if Bel Safon.
I gotta look.
North of there.
And is it the camp on the shore? Is it before the right before the crossing?
This is in verse 7.
33:7. Review of the journey from Egypt to Jordan.
Numbers 33.
Yeah, Numbers 33. I'm there. They journey from Etham, turn back to which faces Baal Zephon, and they camp before Migdol. Read your number 7. Read your verse 7.
And they set out from Etham and turned back to
Pi-Hahiroth.
Yeah, which is east of Baal
Zephon. Ah. I will tell you what I think. I'd have to go back on the computer and go back and do some looking at the words. What version are you reading?
The ESV.
Yeah, okay. The New American Standard says, which faces Baal Zephon. And I think we're going to find that there's an interpretation going on there. And so they believed it was east, so they said east. But the New American Standard doesn't say that. And without picking on ESV or New American Standard, ESV is a great translation. I'm not trying to put the ESV down. But the New American Standard worked hardest of really any of the modern translations of being a word-for-word literal translation. So my first inclination would trust the New American Standard. If we went back and looked, I might find out something else. Let me make a note that probably won't work, but I'll try. Numbers.
Translates it the same way as the NASB as well. So like the KJV and the NKJV translate it the same way.
East or
no,
or faces.
Facing, yeah.
Yeah. I'll still try to go back and look at that. Numbers 33:7. If this note works, we'll see. I can give you a better answer next week.
I'm just curious.
No, that's a great, that's a, those kinds of curiosities are extremely valuable, because otherwise we tell somebody something and they go read this and they go, he was all wet. It's better to get it figured out and know where we're going. Good diligence there. I'm glad you found that.
And I thought about, well, does if Bill Savon was up here way up north, well, it still could be to the east.
Well, in reality, we're actually a little bit on the west side of a north-south line from Bal Savon. It's actually in true degrees, not magnetic, but in true degrees. We don't have to get into that. It's about 10 degrees off of north. To get the canyon's a little about 10 degrees off, and if you keep right on going with that 10 degrees off, you wind up right where the temple for Bal Savon was.
Yeah, the LSB has faces.
Faces?
Not east.
Yeah.
I think without a doubt, east is an interpretive word that the authors of the ESB decided to interpret based upon, I think, what was a traditional understanding of where Bal Savon was at from the Egyptian viewpoint.
Yeah, that's probably right.
Yeah, for sure.
Yeah. I'm pretty confident that, but I will still go to the trouble to try to look that word up on the computer and trace it back and try to figure it out. So that's a good comment, but I think it's pretty sure that's how it's coming out. Verse 3. So verses 1 and 2, God gives them their instruction on where they're going to go camp and gives all this direction that Dr. Glenn Fritz helped us understand. In verse 3, now remember, this is God talking to who?
Moses.
And he tells him this: for Pharaoh will say of the sons of Israel, they're wandering out aimlessly in the land. The wilderness has shut them in. He goes on in verse 4, God says, thus I will harden Pharaoh's heart, and he will chase after them, and I will be honored through Pharaoh and all his army, and the Egyptians will know that I am the Lord. And they did so. So if we go back up to Pharaoh's thoughts, he said in verse 3, this is what Pharaoh's going to think, that you guys are out here wandering aimlessly about in a desert. You're stuck there. Probably can't find your way out, kind of a thought process here. Was that right? No. As a matter of fact, who was leading them?
God.
So they're anything but wandering aimlessly. Okay. But Pharaoh says they're going about around, wandering around. And then in verse 4, after God reveals that Pharaoh's going to decide that's what's happening, he says, thus, in that same way, and for that reason, I will harden Pharaoh's heart. So God's going to intensify Pharaoh's belief and intuition and everything about what he believes what's going on. He says, I'm going to harden his heart, and he will chase after them. And if you just knew that, if that's all you heard, you go, why do you want Pharaoh to come out and chase them? But God gives his purpose, and I will be honored through Pharaoh and all his army, and the Egyptians will know that I am the Lord. So God makes it clear that he's going to glorify himself through Pharaoh chasing the Israelites. And he tells it to Moses, which is interesting to think about in terms of what happens when they actually see Pharaoh when they're out there camped. But hold on to that for when we get there. Probably not today. And his purpose is that they will all know I am the Lord. Now, Pharaoh and his armies, how long are they going to know it? Not very long. About the time the waters to drown them comes crashing in. We know the story that's coming. And then at the end of verse 4, it says, and they did so. Who's they and what did they do? I don't think so. But it could be. But there's nobody there to do something. let's go back to the command in verse 4. God told Moses to tell them, change your direction. We're going down here. We've talked about how what all those words mean, to get you to the sea and to be camped by the sea. And so that's what they did. So why did I make a deal out of that? Those are the kinds of questions I'd really encourage you when you're reading. You know, I read by that stuff all the time, and they did so. But when you see a sentence that, I'm going to use the word vague. It's not vague if you stop and think about it. Those are good questions to ask yourself. Who is they and what did they do? Because you have to stop and think about it to get it in that one. So anything else you'd like to say on those first four verses?
It's interesting to me to think Pharaoh had some scouts or observers following them that way.
Yes. Well, or he was guessing. I mean, could be. Dumb Israelites. They're going to be out there wandering around. I mean, and if he has a feel for how many. If you were a good guide, how tough would it be to get 600,000 men and their families across the desert? You know, now Moses has been out there before, but the rest of the people have been busy making bricks and so on. They're not exactly ready for this kind of a task, I would guess. So
can we explain on that they did so? Why would that not be that Pharaoh's heart was hardened and the Egyptians pursued them as that they did so versus?
Well, because there's no action. God is saying what's going to happen with regard to Pharaoh and his armies and the people. But we have to get down to verse 5 before we see anything happening. So the happening of Pharaoh starts in verse 5. And that's why you really can't. It doesn't quite make sense to say, and they did so, and then we hear, well, what they did. Kind of reverse order. Good question, because I really didn't explain that. But yeah, we're going to start now with what Pharaoh did. So the people are, basically, they changed their course. That was what they were told to do, and they did. So let's read 5 through 9. When the king of Egypt was told that the people had fled, Pharaoh and his servants had a change of heart toward the people. And they said, "What is this we have done that we have let Israel go from serving us?" So he made his chariot ready, and he took his people with him. And he took 600 select chariots and all the other chariots of Egypt with officers over all of them. The Lord hardened the heart of Pharaoh, king of Egypt, and he chased after the sons of Israel as the sons of Israel were going out boldly. Then the Egyptians chased after them with all the horses and chariots of Pharaoh, his horsemen and his army, and they overtook them camping by the sea beside Pi Hahiroth in front of Baal Zephon. Okay, so this is the pursuit of Pharaoh. So in verse 5, Pharaoh was told that the people had left or fled. Why did he need to be told? Go back to Exodus 12, and we're going to start with verse 31. Exodus 12, 31. This is right after the Passover night, and 31 and 32 I'll start with, and it's the bottom of this page. This is Pharaoh. Then he called for Moses and Aaron at night and said, "Rise up, get out from among my people, both you and the sons of Israel, and go. Worship the Lord as you have said. Take both your flocks and your herds as you have said, and go and bless me also." So that is Pharaoh's last interaction with Moses and Aaron. And then if we keep reading in 33 through 36, this is how the common Egyptians or the Egyptian people reacted. The Egyptians urged the people to send them out. So Pharaoh has just given the command, go. But here's the people urging them, send out, get out of the land in haste, for they said, "We're all going to be dead." So the people took their dough before it was leavened. These people are the Israelites. with their kneading bowls bound up with clothes on their shoulders. And the sons of Israel had done according to the word of Moses, for they had requested from the Egyptians articles of silver and articles of gold and clothing. And the Lord had given the people favor in the sight of the Egyptians, so that they let them have their request. Thus they plundered the Egyptians. So who really saw them go? Pharaoh? No, it's the people out there kind of in the street. They're not literally in streets, maybe. I don't know what the setting was. But it's kind of the people of the street out against these Israelites saying, go, take anything you want, just leave, for we're all dead. And so the people are the ones that see this hurried up exodus out of Egypt. And so that's why when we get to verse 5, the word gets back to Pharaoh, okay, they're gone. And the next words to me are interesting, because we tend to think about Pharaoh being the evil person in the story. But look at this. Pharaoh and his servants had a change of heart toward the people, meaning the Israelites. And they said, what have we done that we let Israel go away from serving us? Remember how the book of Exodus started? Here are these people, and we want to suppress them. They're getting big. At some point, they could overtake us. We don't want them to do that. So through hard labor and even violent means, they tried to suppress them because they wanted to keep them. And one of their concerns was if somebody else attacked them, these folks would rise up with the invaders, and then they would leave. They valued this labor force. I mean, and, you know, talk freely. They had 600,000 men to be soldiers, so this is a big labor force that all they had to do was feed them. They didn't have to invest much in these people. And so they realize what they have lost. And so they think they have the ability to get it back. By whose will were the Israelites in Egypt to begin with? God's will. God let Pharaoh enslave them for a time. But God is the one who's at work to make them into a nation, to prep them for the Exodus, to get them to go ready and to fulfill the promise of taking the Holy Lands, or taking the Promised Lands, put the right label on it, and this is a part of the way God was working to accomplish this. And so here's what Pharaoh did. He got his own personal chariot ready. And he took his people with him. So now he's gathering the folks together to go be a part of getting these Israelites back, capturing these people out wandering in the desert. Who knows what he thought? They're going to be starving to death. They'll welcome some hot food. I don't know what he thought. But he went in military fashion, and he took 600 select chariots. So he's got 600 of his best. But he also took every other chariot and the officers over all of them. So Pharaoh has initiated his action. He gathered together the chariots, the forces, the soldiers, and he's ready to go. And the Lord then, it's interesting, then the Lord hardened his heart. Pharaoh didn't need any help from God to decide to go after the Israelites. His head was as big as all outdoors, as I heard in a recent comedy. He was a big-headed guy. He thought whatever he wanted, he could do. And he thought he had the power. He put the power together. We're going to go out, we're going to get these people, and we're going to use our power and our position to get them back. So the Lord hardened the heart of Pharaoh, king of Egypt, and he chased after the sons of Israel as the sons of Israel were going out boldly. And I think we could even back up and say, with Godspeed in the fullness of that term, David mentioned like wings of eagles. These Israelites have confidence, they're going boldly, and things are great as far as their travel is concerned. Then the Egyptians chased after them with all the hordes and the chariots of Pharaoh, his horsemen and his army, and they overtook them. And where did they catch up with them? camping by the sea, near Pi Hahiroth and in front of Bel Siphon. So Pharaoh catches up with them while they're encamped next to the sea and have done just what God asked them to, and there they are. And that's the end of our time today. I didn't try to put you into a cliffhanger, but next time we'll get a chance to see how the Israelites react and move on through the things that God did in order to put them in this situation where God gets glorified. You know, the Israelites are all worried about themselves. That's what God was worried about. He was glorifying himself through this moment. So we will see you next time.